You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, November 18th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, fix the debt, kick the can, plagiarize your letters, all part of a fake grassroots movement that has been faking grassroots for nearly two decades, plus, actually. Also on the program today, unemployment insurance on millions of Americans about to run out. Meanwhile, unions take a big stand out west in Seattle, or actually Everett. Meanwhile, Jeremy Hammond gets 10 years more than Jamie Dimon, just to put it in relief in terms of prison. We will talk about that as the show progresses. Also, the TPP and other so-called free trade agreements losing their battle, I guess, or the administration losing its battle to get fast-track authority to promote those devastating trade deals. Devastating more than anything else to democracy and all that that would entail in terms of worker, consumer, internet protection, labor protection, etc. All that and more on today's program, folks. We will get to all that and more. I am back. Matt and Mike, Friday, I took a personal day as my daughter was on a field trip to Ellis Island, and they needed a chaperone, not just one, but I went to wrangle third graders, and it was the first time I had ever been to Ellis Island. Fascinating. Definitely worth a trip if you have the opportunity, particularly if you get to go with a class and you get in for free. I don't know how much the tickets were, but I don't think they were that expensive. But they've just opened it up recently after Sandy. You don't have the ability to go downstairs and check the computer files for what of your... But I know that at least, at the very least, Mila's maternal grandfather came through there, and her paternal, that would be me, great-grandfather and great-grandmother came through there. So it's pretty fascinating, and I would highly recommend it. But speaking of families, before we get to those other stories, I just cannot help but enjoy this public squabble of a family. This is sort of small bore stuff, but I am relishing it too much not to share with you. As you know, Liz Cheney, the elder of the Cheney daughters, is running for senator in Wyoming. She is attempting to defeat Republican Senator Mike Enzi, and she is within striking distance, if you consider 52 points behind within striking difference. Now, it's quite possible she just doesn't have the name recognition in Wyoming. They may not have heard of the Cheneys. So expect that to close as the race goes forward. But you understand what you have to do to get to the right of Mike Enzi. You need to literally disown your sister, with whom you've had wonderful relations through the years, and in particular, her wife, if she is married to a woman, because of recent changes in our society's perception that gay people should not be second-class citizens, and in some states, they are afforded marriage equality. Apparently, the situation has been chilly between Liz Cheney and her sister, Mary, for several months when Liz Cheney had to come out and say that she was against marriage rights for gay people. This has been simmering within the intra-family squabble has been simmering for some time. Apparently, it came to a head this weekend. On Sunday, Liz Cheney was on Fox News Sunday. And she reiterated that she is opposed to marriage equality, describing it as just an area where we disagree, referring to her sister. Mary and her wife, Heather, apparently were watching the show and took offense to it. Mary headed to Facebook and wrote, "Liz, this isn't just an issue on which we disagree. You're just wrong and on the wrong side of history." Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, my sister seems to feel like she wants to be treated like a human being. And I just disagree. We just disagree. She does not have the same rights as I do. And then, apparently, Heather Poe, Mary Cheney's wife, who apparently has been really been driving this a little bit, said, "I can't help but wonder," and she was on her own Facebook page, "how Liz would feel if, as she moved from state to state," slight dig in the fact that Liz Cheney has just moved to Wyoming to run for office, but that happens often. "She discovered that her family was protected in one, but not the other. Yes, Liz," she added, "in 15 states in the District of Columbia, you are my sister-in-law." And so Liz Cheney, apparently on Sunday, declined to directly address the remarks from her sister and sister-in-law, but said in an email, I guess this is to the New York Times, "I love my sister and her family and have always tried to be compassionate towards them." But what do you say if your compassion does not mean extending to them the same rights as anyone else? You add, "I believe that is the Christian way to behave." End quote. According to the New York Times, people who have spoken to Liz Cheney say she's irritated that her sister is making their dispute public. Yes, there's nothing like those people who say they have no rights to get married like their friends or, in some cases, family do, than being an irritation. Apparently, Liz Cheney believes it's hypocritical for Mary Cheney to take such a hard line now, given that she worked for the election of President Bush, an opponent to same-sex marriage. I would have to say I side with Liz Cheney on this one. It is incredibly hypocritical. And in fact, it was disgusting of Mary Cheney to not only work so hard for the reelection of George Bush, a man who went on television and announced that he was going to support a federal constitutional amendment to enshrine second-class citizen for gay people. And since that time, Mary Cheney has contributed heavily to anti-marriage equality candidates across the country, including Mitt Romney's campaign in 2012. So I think in the end, and as Mary Cheney enjoys the hard-won rights, not hard-won by her, she actually, by all accounts, I mean, if your money speaks in our society, she spent a lot to prevent herself from getting the right to marry her wife. She's enjoying it now. Frankly, I think she lost the right to complain about it. She has a personal dispute, not a political one, because politically speaking, she has done everything she can in terms of politics, supporting politicians who would oppose her right. So she should just take it up at Christmas time. That also seems to be the Christian thing to do in this situation.
It's even worse because, you know, Liz actually doesn't support a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage.
Right.
And has said it's a state issue and supported some civil protections. That already puts her infinitely better than all of those people you talked about that Mary contributed money to.
I don't know. What's good for the goose is good for the goose, I guess, in this situation. All right, so let's move to the I think it is no surprise to listeners of this program that I have always found Fix the Debt and their tiny cousin, I don't know, or their offspring, Kick the Can, which is the millennial version of Fix the Debt, to be a huge joke. We had the head of Kick the Can on this program, didn't we, some time ago?
Nick Triano.
I don't know. I don't even remember how that went, other than the fact that he didn't seem to really answer a lot of the questions.
Shocking.
But, and you will recall that a couple of weeks ago, Fix the Debt had a Q&A in which I was involved in asking a lot of questions. They shut that down very quickly. Almost the precursor to the Ask JPM, Morgan Chase, anything you want, which they had to actually preemptively cancel because people were tweeting at them so hard. Well, now, sadly, another tragedy has befallen the Fix the Debt people. It has become clear that it's virtually impossible for them to make the case that they are a grassroots organization. They have been, and of course, you know, this was always something they were just pretending, not just for us rubes' benefit, but really more for the benefit of the mainstream media. It's so important that they show that there's just a sea of millennials out there and an ocean of centrist, no-label types of people who just want Washington to get down to business and cut Social Security so that we don't have this multi-generational theft. There's intergenerational theft between old people and young people who deserve a chance. So Fix the Debt, it was quite clear from that Twitter smackdown that they have no one who really is interested in asking them a legitimate question because they're an illegitimate outfit. And apparently, John Romano, the press secretary for the Inside the Beltway PR campaign, fixed the debt. This is coming from Mary Batari at Campaign for America's Future. Has been caught writing op-eds for college students and placing the identical op-eds in papers across the country. Now, just contemplate this for a moment, folks. This is something, of course, that fake grassroots organizations do all the time. But these are college students who ostensibly are driven by the fear of this intergenerational theft. And frankly, these are exactly the type of people you think would have the time to write these op-eds, or at least just massage them in some way. Right? Because these are people who are looking to get a job with kick the can or fix the debt. Or maybe they already have one. And that is, how much money do we have to pay you to put your name on this? I mean, I hope these college kids got some money. Otherwise, what we're looking at is intergenerational theft from these older people at kick the can or at the fix the debt. The identical op-eds were discovered by Florida's Gainesville Sun. If you liked University of Florida's student Brandon Scott's column last Sunday about the national debt, you'll also should enjoy columns by Dartmouth College student Thomas Wang and University of Wisconsin Jennifer Pavelek on the issue. They're the same columns. They each included the same first-person passage describing the students' work with Campaign to Fix the Debt and its millennial arm, The Can Kicks Back. The Sun had this to say. It is the Sun's policy not to publish AstroTurf pieces written by advocacy groups and only signed by supporters, wrote the editorial page editor. Advocacy groups and others should lay off the AstroTurf and outright plagiarism unless they want to discredit themselves and their cause as well. I am sorry.
Hey, what happened?
That already happened. They have been discredited. Now, we know that this is another Pete Peterson funded, I guess, pay to play, I guess, in some ways. He funded $5 million to fix the debt to get it off the ground. J.P. Morgan Chase pitched in half a million. And GE contributed $1 million. And its entire grassroots network are just basically a series of PR firms. What Fix the Debt fails to tell students is that its leaders, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, they of the Gangnam-style parodies, not only wants to cut Social Security and Medicare for those teat-sucking old people, but it also attacks college students by calling for higher interest rates on student loans. And to change the law to allow those interest rates to kick in even before the student graduates from college. This, folks, is nothing new, and I anticipate we're going to hear more about this. Back in 1997, Fairness and Accuracy in Media had a piece saying the media have been duped by a clever campaign whose intention is to get rid of those nasty Social Security programs. Perhaps the idea of generational warfare was too good of a story to question. Whatever the reason, the media have turned an ideological assertion into conventional wisdom, and in the process have distorted the political voice of an entire generation. Back then, it was my generation, Generation X. And it was an organization called Americans for Generational Equity or AGE. And as the authors of this piece wrote, an organization that demonstrates with proper funding it's possible to launch an unsubstantiated idea and see it turn into the standard media view. And who was one of the big funders of Age back at that time? Well, it was funded by a five-star general of this generational war, Pete Peterson, an investment banker and president of the Concord Coalition. Peterson, in turn, funded both Lead or Leave, now defunct, and Third Millennium. 13 of Third Millennium's 40 founders were affiliated with the Madison Center, including Third Millennium board member Jonathan Carl, who at that time was a resident Gen X political analyst at CNN and has moved on to ABC News. So there you have it. Yes, the Third Way was all bound up in that. So, and at the time, their agenda was accepted as post-partisan. Yes, indeed, folks, what is old is new again. Pete Peterson, one of the luggers, you know, someone tweeted me and asked, "What does Pete Peterson really think that he's going to get a return on his investment for that $1 billion?" And I would say to you, when you have billions upon billions of dollars and you have no way to figure out how to spend it, sometimes your returns on investment are not just in dollars, but in legacy, ladies and gentlemen. And this guy's been working for over 25 years, spending his fortune, which he has made by sucking money out of our economy, to destroy the meager payments to the elderly in this country in their retirement. And, well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I was thinking about this morning, how just creepy it is on some level to have all of these resources at your disposal and focus on micro-targeting, essentially just making more people's lives generally worse. It's just, I mean, I'm not saying it's surprising or unexpected, but that particular obsession with those programs and cutting them is, and being so relentless, creepy. It's just the word that keeps occurring to me.
It's incredibly creepy, but I mean, you know, look, sometimes it's an easier marker to lay down.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're going to do good in the world, it's just a drop in the bucket. But if you can do some real damage, that's something that I wonder if he ever got these cuts to Social Security pass, if he would make himself like a big trophy, or maybe just a statue of himself.
I'm just saying, but would you just, that's on some level, obviously completely non-applicable to him. If you sat down and you accomplished that and you were like, you know, I made all this money doing whatever, and then I worked so hard.
Think, look, the bottom line is that for guys like this, Social Security and Medicare represent the cornerstone of a social insurance, social welfare program in this country, which came out of specifically part of the New Deal. And to be able to turn the clock back on that, I think is, you know, it's a feather in a cap. And if you've got a couple billion to spare, I mean, come on. You get to parade around with that hat and that feather in that hat. And the Washington Post yesterday jumped right in, I guess, out of concern of the recent proposals emanating from the Senate, amongst other places, emanating probably, as far as I can tell, by anybody who's done any of the reckoning, from Duncan Black in his decision to write a couple of pieces for USA Today about it a year or so ago. The bill in the Senate, sponsored by Tom Harkin, and it's cousin in the House, sponsored by Linda Sanchez, that would increase Social Security benefits. As you know, it would increase Social Security benefits by $60 a month. Wow. And provide a measure of inflation, which is specific for elderly people. As you know, inflation is greater for the elderly than the rest of us. It would extend the wage and salary income to the 12.4% Social Security payroll tax, subject all wage and salary income to that tax, as opposed to only drawing from income up to $113,000, as is presently done. Are you ready for these numbers, folks? Hold on to your hats. For someone earning $200,000 per year, this would mean a tax increase of more than $4,000 per year. $4,000 per year. That would be, let me do the math, 2% tax increase. For someone earning $1 million, the tax increase would be $58,000. Going to have to wait another year to get that new Lexus. It is, in the words of the Washington Post, a massive transfer of income from upper-income Americans to the retired. What they don't say is to the middle-income and lower-income people in this country, to the 50% of Americans who live on nothing but their Social Security benefits. Even the rich have finite resources. Government can only go to that well so many times. Actually, they can go to that well a lot of times. We have the lowest tax rates still in the history of this country. Short of maybe a brief segment of the Clinton administration. Why spend this gob of revenue on the elderly, who are already heavily protected by the federal government? That is, by Social Security and Medicare. The bill's authors warn of a looming retirement crisis because of low savings rates and disappearing private sector pensions. In fact, the poverty rate among the elderly is 9.1% lower than the national rate of 15%. I wonder why that might be. Perhaps it's because of Social Security. And I should also note that we have seen a huge spike in poverty amongst elderly women. The number of women over the age of 65 living in extreme poverty jumped by 18% last year. This is according to the National Women's Law Center. One factor, they say, might be cuts in recent years to Social Security Administration funding, which may be making applications for supplemental security income more difficult. But let's get back to the horror of a millionaire paying nearly $60,000 more a year in taxes. Unchecked entitlement spending for the elderly crowds out spending on programs that might help them, as well as defense, research, infrastructure, and law enforcement. Okay, now hold on for one second. Entitlement spending for the elderly crowds out spending on programs that might help them. In other words, if you give a woman living in extreme poverty or someone who's relying on Social Security for their entire income an extra $60 a month, plus perhaps a more generous cost of living increase, there won't be enough money to give them money for something else. Presumably, like some type of, I don't know, travel fund or free dance lessons. They go on to say, as well as defense spending, as if we don't have an already bloated defense budget. Research. Infrastructure in law enforcement. You know, I'm just waiting for the Washington Post editorial saying we need to raise the Social Security taxes to fund research, law enforcement, and infrastructure spending. Do not hold your breath. We will not hear it. And know that not only have we spoken extensively on the failure of 401ks, at this point, for people entering into retirement, know that according to a Social Security Administration paper, volume number 9, number 3, they anticipate a decline in family income will be much larger for the last wave of boomers born from 61 through 65 than those born from 46 through 50. Those are the people, incidentally, who are now hitting retirement with poorly funded 401k plans because of how many more people were forced out of defined contribution pensions. Excuse me, defined benefit pensions than defined contribution. 401ks are defined contribution benefits as opposed to the defined benefit pensions that we all used to have. 26% of last wave boomers would have lower family incomes at age 67, and only 11% would see their income increase because of this dynamic of how many people were switched at that time to some type of 401k scheme from a defined benefit program. And all this coming at a time where we are seeing, or on the verge of seeing, nearly one month from now, 1.3 million people who will lose access to an emergency program providing them with additional weeks of jobless benefits. In other words, unemployment insurance, which was extended in the wake of the financial crisis, will end. There'll be a further 850,000 who will be denied benefits in the first quarter of 2014. We're talking about over 2 million people over the course of 2 months will lose their unemployment insurance. And then by the end of 2014, as many as 4.8 million could lose unemployment benefits. Not to mention the implications of these people not having a way of buying food, of maintaining a car to try and get to a job interview, maintaining a wardrobe so they can go in and get a job interview. The Congressional Budget Office notes that unemployment insurance is one of the most effective forms of government stimulus. Why? Because everyone on unemployment insurance takes every dollar they get, they go out and they spend it. I think it has a multiplier effect of like 1.7. Worse, 4 million Americans have been looking for work more than 6 months. And the share of working age population with a job has declined over the past year. We have seen private businesses picked up their hiring over the past couple of years. It is because of government cuts, because of austerity, because of the sequester, we are seeing the shrinkage of our job force. The expiration of emergency jobless benefits because of the lack of stimulus effect from those unemployment insurance, according to the Economic Policy Institute, will reduce job growth by 310,000 jobs next year. Already 2.5 million unemployed who have not worked in the past 6 months or so are receiving no federal jobless benefits. And there was a really just tragic piece in the New York Times about the revolving door of unemployment, where people who have been out of work for extended periods of time have that much more trouble getting back into the job force. You have a 20 to 30% chance of finding a new job if you are a newly jobless worker. By the time you're out of work for 6 months, the chances drop to 1 in 10. This is according to the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. Long-term joblessness is up 213% in this country. So we have sequestration, which is taking out about 60% of unemployment checks this summer and fall. We have the ending of the extended emergency unemployment checks via the stimulus. That's going to hit 2.5 million people, 2.2 million people by February of 2014. By the end of next year, over 4 million people who have lost their jobless benefits. Just stunning. And we're still talking about more cuts and maintaining this sequester. Just a moment of levity. This in the Washington Post today. Billionaire casino magnate Sheldon Adelson is now spending millions of dollars to prepare a public campaign to fight online gambling as a danger to children, the poor, and others who could be exploited by easy access to internet betting. He, of course, Adelson, is best known for upscale casino resorts in Nevada and more recently in Asia, where I believe he is being investigated for potentially bribing officials. He says the practice of online gambling is a danger to society and could tarnish the industry's traditional business model, i.e. his business model. He's begun hiring lobbyists and public relations experts in Washington and in state capitals nationwide to press his case in what is shaping up to be the most heavily lobbied debates in 2014. The coalition hopes to enlist organizations representing women, African Americans, and Hispanics, all seen as likely to be sympathetic to the cause. Cha-ching. Cha-ching. Oh, that's not in the piece. In my 15 years of working with him, I don't think I've ever seen him this passionate about any issue, says Andy Abood, Adelson's top political advisor. I'll bet. Unbelievable.
That would be amazing. I'd love to sit down with him, and I would be like, I will trade you. If you imagine if you had the power to be like, no online gambling, end of the occupation in the West Bank. Got to pick one.
That's right.
That would be amazing. I would love to see that. I mean, it's not even a question. He would bail on the occupation in a
second. Well, I think the key would have to be to get legislation passed in Israel that all of the occupation is to be funded exclusively by internet gambling. And that's the thing that keeps Sheldon Adelson awake at night.
Why do you got to be so negative, Sam? Maybe he just cares about the children.
Maybe it's just the children he cares about.
I love it's like the traditional business model of like, which like evolved from breaking people's kneecaps and like putting them in comas when they didn't pay back to like just gentlemanly bankrupting people and destroying their savings
right.
because of gambling addictions.
Right. First off, one of the problems with the traditional model that is not there with the online gaming is you cannot be sure that the people who are betting online are getting drunk at your tables. Maybe there'll have to be a breathalyzer attached to your computer so that you, unless you're blowing a .10 or something, you can't gamble.
He's really looking out for the customers. He's worried he can't comp them for their room via online gambling.
Unbelievable.
So what happens when he makes an inroad in the online gambling market? The communications turnaround strategy is going to be fascinating to watch.
I received a letter from 7-year-old Jenny Kramer, who is a second grader at a elementary school in Ohio. Dear Mr. Adelson, I beg of you, please, allow for internet gambling. Its funding is paying for my new school books. And as soon as I read that letter, I decided I must change course and offer a full suite of internet gambling through Adelson Incorporated.
The Torah says when the child speaks on gaming industries, the wise man listens.
If I can... As Rabbi Akiba said when he was at Yavna, which I would remind you was part of ancient Judea Samaria. All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the better half. Jeremy Hammond receives 10 years plus.
Fun.
Yeah. The fun part of the show. But we'll also talk about J.P. Morgan. Their practice, I guess, their defense will probably be, Sheldon Adelson can do it. We can do it, too. The unbelievable, unbridled, I don't know if it's really nepotism. It sounds more like bribery. That... has anyone checked to see if Maria Bartiromo or Bartiromo has apologized to Alex Perrine? Wonder if he's received a gift basket from those folks at CNBC. We will talk about that. Also, a couple of nice emails. Oh, I got a good email I want to read. We will talk about. I got a bunch of emails talking about the vegan diet. That someone called in about when the EPA got rid of or banned trans fats, which turned out to be vegetable oil just cooked to such a degree, apparently, that it turns into plastic. The FDA. Who did I say?
You said EPA.
Oh, the FDA. Sorry. Got a very nice email from listener Charles. And this is a good time to remind you, if you want to become a member, you can become a member today at majority.fm, 33 cents a day. If you want to give a gift of a Majority Report membership, just email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Makes a wonderful holiday gift. Maybe we should set up something specifically for that. I don't know how we would go about doing that. But I started listening to the show about a year ago, writes listener Charles. I wanted to know that your interviews and discussions renewed my interest in public policy and economics. I enrolled in an econ program to obtain my degree, and I am seriously considering grad school. Wonder if this is Bush and Chains. Your show is not merely informative and entertaining, especially with the fun half, trademark, logo. In my case, it's inspirational. All the best and keep up the excellent work. Thank you so much for this email, Charles. Much appreciated. And be prepared to have to be our on-call econ advisor. Put you in the Rolodex.
Sometimes Bush and Chains comes at us, and we just don't know what to say. We're just overwhelmed.
I hope Bush and Chains is figuring out a way we can accept bitcoins for this program.
Bush and Chains has been having a battle on Twitter with some other listener
about bitcoins.
About bitcoins, yeah.
I'll accept bitcoins. I may accept also baseball cards. Are they still selling like hotcakes too?
I would not accept baseball cards.
All right, no, not baseball cards, but bitcoins.
Bitcoins. I love how Matt is like the voice of reason on payment methods online.
Matt, trading cards aren't the business it used to be.
I know. You know, I held on to them thinking that they were gonna.
Yeah, they fell in value. If you want something in that realm, first edition like comic books. That's
The only first edition I have is Firestorm. And that apparently doesn't seem to be terribly valuable. Because you don't even know what that comic is. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, of course, we have a special libertarian line open for you today. That's 646-257-3920. If you are a college student and a libertarian, we will open up another line for you at 646-257-3920.
Although you might want to pause and try to negotiate with whatever group is sponsoring you around the payment method for the call.
That's right.
And get your talking points.
Are you a student who is promoting the Can Kicks Back? You can call toll free. It's all money. Although some charges may apply. 646-257-3920. You can IM us. We'll be right back. After this, tomorrow on the program, I should tell you, in the better half, we're going to do some type of simulcast with David Pakman. He wanted to interview me. It just occurred to me, we're doing a simulcast. He doesn't do a live show. I don't know what this is all about, but my birthday is coming up. So this is part of a prank, guys. It's a birthday prank. All right, we will find out tomorrow in the better half of the program. So,
well, now you've unwrapped something.
All right, we'll see you in the better half.